Go. Tonight is December 20th, and we are going to be studying this very interesting unit number 6. And the reason I am so glad that we were able to squeeze in this additional session is twofold. First, if you look at the syllabus of the kinds of issues that we are examining in this course. Why don't you go to that if you have it in the beginning of the, or you can just look at the tabs. Yeah. You notice that the first, after the initial two sessions, which we covered in one session, the radioactive seed is right here, Ethan.
That's what happened.
We will do a Geiger counter over you at the end. Just make sure that you're okay.
I have a lead shield.
After the introductory session, these sessions have something in common. What would you say they have in common? Look at the text. Look at the titles of the sessions that we've covered up until now. What would you say they have in common?
Yeah.
Food production, neighborly relations, mass incarceration, modern slavery. Okay, that's good, good, good. They are ethical issues. They belong in this class. There's a kind of a global quality to these.
They're very contemporary.
I hope actually the ones in the second part of the course are as well. But the ones in the second part have a different quality. Let's take a look at those. Skip over for the moment. Torture and just war, because that really is the completion of this first part of the course, and look at the next ones. Advanced directives, disability and inclusion, surrogacy, better than normal, that's the ethics of enhancement. What do they have in common that might be different from these?
They're individualized.
They're about individual ethical decisions that we might have to make about our own bodies or our children's bodies, or our own way of life, okay? So these really do fall into two different categories, and what I was hoping to do is to complete this unit before the turn of the year, this time of peace and well-being, and then we move into a new set of issues in January. And it actually, interestingly enough, events conspired. I'm sorry?
So it's torture and just war.
I knew you were going to ask me about that. So the events have conspired to assist us. How so? The same time that I realized that it would be possible, if people could make it, to meet this evening, I received an email from the editors of this volume and of the materials that we've been using, asking that if we haven't yet taught the torture unit, to put it off, because they are in the process of editing it. Because there was some feedback from last year. And
weren't you prescient?
No, I was not prescient at all. All I was fortunate. I mean, so in other words, we are going to study this unit, and that will kind of bring to a close what you might call social justice ethical issues of the kind that we've been looking at. And then we'll take a break, and we'll look at these more personal issues in January. Make sense? Okay. So,
today's material?
Oh, yes. This class is just getting better and better. So much, so ethical. You know, it's all here. It's interesting. They've given it different titles in different places. This is now called Modern Day Slavery and the Ethics of Consumerism. So, yes, please take one packet and pass the rest on. And I don't know whether Carol has already asked that you fill out, she's on top of things. So, you know, there's no question about that. And in fact, there's a folder here that says Carol Kotler on it. So, Carol.
Uh-oh.
So, here.
I'm in trouble now.
Okay. And I should tell you that in the course of preparing for tonight's class, hi, welcome, Zoe. There are plenty of extra seats, and just find yourself a chair. You can. This is radioactive, but it's.
I got one more coming.
So please, there are some other white chairs there. Find a comfy place, and then we'll we'll get started. Okay. So I was going to say that there are a number of materials that I discovered, and they tend to have, 10, 15, in one case, 57 pages to them. And so at a certain point, I was ready to have Marie make some copies, and I thought, we're moving toward a more electronic age, so I'll mention a couple of other materials, and, and they'll go out in electronic form, and you can print them out. But there is one text that we will be using in a few moments. But for the most part, we're going to be using these texts that you see here. Now, did anybody get a chance to listen to Rabbi Tucker? I listened to it several times because I was trying to clarify what the materials meant by suggesting that it's really important to listen to him, to first look at the materials before listening to him. I think because it was very pithy. It was a pithy presentation. I'm not sure that he totally covered as much as I would have liked. So we're gonna review it. We're gonna look at his material, and we're gonna look at a few other pieces of material. Okay, enough of the introductory talk. Let's move to today. Now, last week we studied
mass incarceration.
Mass incarceration. We studied imprisonment. Today we are studying what?
Slavery.
So you're thinking to yourself, wait a second, I studied imprisonment last week, now it's slavery. How are they different? What's the difference here?
Why that order, though?
Before we get to the order, let's just try to understand what we mean by the two phenomena. The first phenomenon, the phenomenon of imprisonment,
that's state control, where this is more personal.
Okay. It had to do with the question of being imprisoned for presumably unethical criminal behavior. In other words, it was justified imprisonment. What we're looking at today is unjustified imprisonment. We have a problem, actually, in English. Probably every language has this problem. How do you distinguish between a prisoner, a captive, a hostage? Those are all very different, but you might be tempted to call them all captives. And actually, in Hebrew, you sometimes can use the same word for all of them, and that can be very, very troubling, because they ain't the same. Okay? So last week, we were looking at prisoners. Now, someone can be unjustifiably imprisoned for an offense, but that's not the same thing as being held in a dungeon, or being held as a slave and being forced to work, or being kept in a house and forced to produce. What we're talking about here, and this, I think, answers David's question about the order, is, if I could say, it's a kind of a heightened order of what? Of ethical violation. Now, you might say, no, that's equally or bad. What we saw last week, the idea of putting people in prison for 30, 40 years and putting them in solitary confinement is terrible, terrible, terrible. But this is a little bit... there's something more insidious about this because, yes, you're right, it's not necessarily state actors. In fact, it usually isn't. It's individuals who are actually imprisoning against their will, abusing, exploiting human beings, even to this very day. Now, if I said the word slavery and you weren't in this class, you were just driving down the street and you heard the word slavery, what images come to your mind? Or what image comes to your mind?
Without the word modern, you're saying.
Without the word modern. So when you think about slavery in history, in the world, what comes to your mind?
People work. What people working in the cotton fields, like people just.
Okay, so you shoot back to the antebellum South, for example. Mm-hmm. Great example. We have it in our country, and it's pretty close to modern times. Yeah.
The Jews in Egypt.
Jews in Egypt. Okay. Yeah.
I think of the folks I've seen in Chinese factories.
Okay. So that's pretty shocking. You're thinking not just of like the antebellum South or 3,000 years ago in Egypt, but contemporary China. People working. Yeah, another.
When Michelle is here, she may counter me on that.
I'm sure she will. I'm just in general. But I mean, the fact is, different people might see the same phenomenon differently. But okay, that's what you see. That's how you experience it. Are they the same? What do they have in common? What might be their differences? How do we define what's a slave? Is it even really important to define that distinction? Because as we'll see in these materials, we're going to really extend our concern from total slaves to people who are exploited, people who are made to work in inhumane conditions, people who are, in fact, become enslaved to their employers, but maybe not enslaved in the way that the slaves in antebellum South were enslaved, or the slaves of ancient Egypt. You know, when you think about the slaves in ancient Egypt, you think about taskmasters. Taskmasters, the name itself. Taskmasters have what? They have the power of life and death over the slave. Whatever they want to do, they can do. By the way, it's interesting that the initial reactions from people in this room did not include Jews in Eastern Europe during World War II. You know that much of the Nazi interest in the Jews had to do with money and had to do with slave labor. Mm-hmm. Many Jews mm-hmm. were slave laborers during the
Holocaust. I don't think that message has resonated as well as it probably should have. That they were used as labor force rather than just to be tortured and whatever else you want to say about it.
Well, that's interesting because I've taken courses in the Holocaust and there's been a lot of attention paid. So maybe not in the general, community or environment. But for example, if you ever have seen Schindler's List, for example, you were exposed to, a group of coddled slave laborers. But you can see from some of the scenes elsewhere in that film just what it meant to be a slave laborer, which meant you could be shot and killed by, your overseers at any moment. Yeah.
But in the general, forgetting if they got you angry, what you might do to them, in the general slave population in the South and the U.S., you didn't want to injure your slave because then you were losing a piece of property, whereas the Jews in the Holocaust weren't viewed as property in that sense of being a valuable property they cared about preserving in better health so they could be more productive as a workforce.
Yesh v'yesh, as they say in Hebrew. There were some who were, in fact, there's a conversation just bringing up Schindler's List. There's one conversation in that film. I mean, I last saw it 6 years ago, so I can't tell you. I can remember every word. Where they're talking about, him worried about his Jews because they represent an economic advantage to him. So he doesn't want them. He doesn't want them put to death. He doesn't want them taken away from him. So, in fact, even under the Nazi regime, there was a sense that not all Jews were totally fungible. They weren't totally, interchangeable. There were some that were worth more than others. For example, the film about the counterfeiters, the Jews, the special people who were able to counterfeit money. You might have seen that a few years ago at the Boston Jewish Film Festival. Yeah, so it's pretty extraordinary. I mean, they had these, and so they were kept alive for that purpose. Okay, so even under the Nazis, you do have the sense that, this might be worthwhile to me. But what we're going to take a look at are, you really, really have two goals tonight, and we're going to move. The first goal is look at these texts. There's some amazing texts. We need to have a sense of what the Jewish tradition has said about slaves. But then very quickly, I want to get to the second part of our class this evening, which is, given all that, given the situation in the world today, in America today, even in America today, what's our responsibility? Not such a simple question to answer. I mean, there are glib answers I could give you, but they're not so simple. So it's really not too different from, for example, when we were talking about fracking. Boy, it'd be easier to simply say, it's really simple, don't frack. Instead, buy your oil from Saudi Arabia. I mean, really, that's a really good thing to do. Right, not so simple. Okay, so let's take a look at these texts. And I guess the first thing to do is just to remind ourselves. Let me pull out my own unit here. Is to remind ourselves that we were slaves to the Pharaoh in the land of Egypt. And then the Bible is really fascinating. It has us coming out of Egypt, and we get to Mount Sinai, and we get the Ten Commandments, and then comes, you know, the details, the detailed laws. And the first detailed law has to do with the fact that if we enslave a fellow Israelite, that Israelite can only be enslaved for 6 years and must be freed.
But only if it's a Hebrew.
Only if it's a Hebrew. Now, it's a very interesting little dance it's a little bit obscure and unclear in the Bible sometimes whether it's talking about slaves in general or just Israelite slaves. Certainly by the rabbinic period, as we're going to see, a lot of the protections that are given to Israelite slaves get extended and universalized. But even if you look at some of these rules, for example, in text number 1, we have this notion that the Hebrew slave, at least, shall be freed in the seventh year. And what is also true there?
Can't go empty-handed.
Doesn't go empty-handed. You got to give him some gifts. Why do you give him gifts? Why doesn't he go empty-handed? Why not send him out empty-handed? What's the problem with that?
So he doesn't become a slave again.
He might become a slave again because so much of slavery in the ancient world had to do with economic inadequacy. You can't support yourself. You can't make a living. So therefore, you indenture yourself. At least you'll get three square meals a day, or at least one square meal a day. Okay. Now, the interesting thing, though, is that you learn about the biblical or the early Jewish attitude towards slavery not just from these statements about what a master must or must not do, but from these curious other little stories. So one of them is, what if a slave actually does not want to go free? It's a really strange thing to imagine, right? But let's imagine that after 6 years, the slave says, I don't want to go anywhere. I want to stay here. So what has to? Look at text number 2. It's a very strange text, isn't it? We don't usually, study this in Hebrew school, so I'll mention it to you here. You take the slave, and what do? Where do you go? You go to the mezuzah, and you bang an awl into his ear at the mezuzah. Okay? Mm-hmm. Very strange. So the question is, of course, why? Why do you do this? And, of course, there's some interpretations in text 3. Does anybody remember what those are? If you happen to have read the material or looked at the video, what do you say? What's the idea? Why take the ear of the slave and bang it and make a hole in it, basically, and bang it into the wall, into the mezuzah, which is the doorpost? Yeah, Heidi?
It's because it's to remind him that he wasn't listening, he wasn't paying attention.
Yeah, sort of like, this is a strange kind of a slave. This is a guy who didn't listen, so we're going to make sure he hears it. It's a little strange.
Yeah.
A little strange. Okay? We learn something about the Israelite approach to slavery by understanding the context in which this rather strange custom arose. In the Babylonian society in which ancient Judaism arose, there were sometimes slaves who would not acknowledge that they were slaves. The exact opposite. You'd get someone who perhaps was trying to escape and would deny that he was a slave of this particular master. What would be done to such a slave? The answer is...
Same thing.
Not the same thing, but something very similar. Begins with S. Similar. You bring him to the doorpost and you chop off his ear.
No. Oh.
Because he didn't listen. Now... It's very interesting. So again, in the society, okay, I'm not making this up, okay? You would take a person, bring him to the doorpost, cut off his ear, okay? And that means when you look at that slave, you know this is somebody who you got to watch out for,
that
right?
If he ran away 3 times.
I'm sorry?
I don't want
to think about what happened if he ran away 3 times. So in a sense, this is kind of a similar situation. This is a slave who's free but doesn't want to acknowledge he's free. You see what I mean? It's kind of a reversal in a sense. Now, moving right along, we could talk more about... the fate of slaves in ancient Israel and trace it up through the generations. But frankly, I want to advance this a little bit, and the materials help in this regard, that we want to see the application of these principles of concern for the slave. For example, a master in ancient Israel could not abuse his slave. If a master of Israel injured his slave, what was the slave entitled to? His freedom. If you injure your slave, the slave goes free. If you kill your slave, guess what? You get put to death. Fascinating. Boy, what kind of a slave is that? That's not really what I had in mind, right, when I talked about slavery. So you can see that the institution of the enslavement of Hebrews, at least, in ancient Israel, you know, as it says in the Talmud, a man who buys himself a slave has just bought himself a master. So you see that there's already incipient labor law buried within the law of enslavement. And so let's take a look at some incipient labor law. We have this very, very interesting little Talmudic passage in text 4. And it is complicated, but I'll try to sum it up. There is a principle in Jewish law, which, by the way, exists in American law as well, and it's one of the fun and famous cases that you study in law school, which is that an employer cannot insist on what's called specific performance from an employee. And the classic case in law school, I don't know if you studied it, David, is the case of the famous opera singer who's hired to sing in this opera. And the night comes and she refuses to sing. Now, can the court order her to sing? Answer is no, she's not a slave. She can pay, they can insist that she pay damages if the opera house lost all this money because she refused to pay, but they cannot actually force her to sing because she's not a slave. She's not enslaved. A contract for employment must never be interpreted as indentured servitude. For the same reason, you could not, in general, you could not agree to terms of employment that were more than a certain number of years. You couldn't promise that you're going to work for your employer for 25 years, lest there be even the implication that you could insist, that the employer could insist on what's called specific performance. Now, do you understand what I mean? Mm-hmm. You can pay damages, but you cannot insist that a person actually physically do what he might even have promised to do.
But they could keep her from singing elsewhere.
Yeah, that's true. I'm sorry?
Then how did the baseball owners of older days get away with the reserve clause in baseball contracts?
I actually am not familiar with it. But I don't want to take too much time with this, but are you saying that
they couldn't force them to play, but they could keep them from playing for anybody else?
That's right.
So okay. That essentially you could divide them. But that's the same thing. She couldn't sing for somebody else, but they couldn't force the person to take the field. It's the same concept. The singer isn't forced to sing that performance.
So you call it a loophole.
Sing across the hall.
But it's a very, but the fact of the matter is the employee in that context is in fact a free person. And that is the underlying theme both for the law of slavery and the law of employment in Jewish law, which is that we are slaves or servants. By the way, it's the same word in Hebrew. An eved is a slave or a servant. We are slaves to whom?
God.
The Kadosh Baruch Hu, to God. We are not slaves to slaves. It's considered demeaning to think of... In other words,
people.
That's what
we are not servants of servants. We're not servants of other servants. We are servants only of the Holy One. Blessed be the Holy One. So, and that's why even in the Talmudic period, if you called someone an Eved, it was like using the N-word. Okay? It was considered to be demeaning because only a slave could be called a slave, not a free person. All right. Mm-hmm. So the whole notion of not having agency is considered to be a source of embarrassment and humiliation. Now, let's see what happens when we look at the kinds of contemporary situations that we might call very similar to slavery today, even though we might not use that word. So, are you familiar with the whole issue of trafficking? The trafficking of human beings. So what do we mean by trafficking? And could someone give us a definition and try to explain what it is? Ethan?
Well, it's usually someone is duped into putting themselves in some position where they are now powerless and can only survive at the hands of their captor and have to do whatever the captor says.
Okay, so there are certain kinds of situations that lend themselves to trafficking. So, for example, let's say you have a group of very poor people in one country. You have a relatively wealthy country someplace else. These poor young people growing up in this country, maybe that country is the Philippines, and the wealthier country is the United States. They are informed by supposedly well-meaning, but in fact unscrupulous people, that they can, in fact, transport them to America, and they'll be able to make a lot of money and send it back to their parents and their family members. So sometimes these people will actually gather a lot of money from friends and from others, and they'll pay to get this airplane ticket, this visa, and go all the way to, let's say, America, where they discover the following. First of all, it's possible that their passport will be taken away from them by their employer, because he will say, I will give this back to you when you've paid me back for this transportation. Then maybe they're sleeping 10 to a room, and then maybe they're employed in some kind of an environment where they don't have a lot of contact with other people. And even though theoretically you could say they are free to walk out the door, they also are informed that they are in debt. And so, in fact, they're being charged exorbitant rents for these hovels where they live with 9 or 10 other people. Perhaps they are also being charged exorbitant rates of interest on loans, because after all, they borrowed money from the employer in order to make this trip in the first place. And perhaps they are being lied to, which is not unsurprising, okay? And lo and behold, you get very, very easily, especially if you're dealing with people who don't know the local language, especially if you get people who can become addicted to drugs that are provided by the employer, you get a situation where we're seeing what amounts to a close approximation to ancient slavery right in our own backyard. Yeah?
Even taking aside the transportation of one group of nationals to another, you have the old company store in the United States where, you know, Tennessee Airport used to sing, I owe my soul
to the company store. What David is referring to is that there was, even in this country with local American citizen employees, there were certain situations where companies would bring employers to a new town that was built just for them, and they were given housing by the company, and they bought food at the company store, and they worked in the company factory. And, you know, it seemed kind of nice on one level, but on the other level, it really wasn't that nice, because there was this sense that the company really controlled the economy of the individuals, and often they were exploited. I think the key issue here is exploitation. If you have exploitation, you have what amounts to, I think, slavery. And if you have what amounts to slavery, if it looks like slavery, if it smells like slavery, maybe the rules that used to apply to slavery should apply here, and maybe we should be doing something about it. Okay? Now, among the kinds of enslavement is the sex trade. Trafficking in women in particular, although men as well, but in particular women, for the purpose of providing sexual pleasure, is that what you said?
Well
you could, whatever you want to say, but sexual services, okay? But it's really something that is an insidious thing, because you could look at it from one direction, and it just seems like a very fair transactional relationship in a free economy, and you look at it from another perspective, and you're talking about the exploitation of often of human beings who often don't have a full awareness of their rights. You know, it's interesting. I was driving today. I don't remember where I was driving from or to, but I turned on WGBH, and there was an interview with Mara Healy, is her name, our Attorney General, about her efforts to address trafficking in the state, the Commonwealth, of Massachusetts. Apparently there was a big bust just last week, and she spoke about it, about this. I think there was some kind of the opposite of a, you know, the Underground Railroad, basically. It was kind of a transport from one place to another, and it was basically trafficking in human beings across state lines to exploit them. And this was an area of serious concern. And she said that, one of the efforts that's necessary to address trafficking is the following. You could argue that trafficking, especially, let's say, sex trafficking, although it applies really across the board, and I'll give you an example from another industry, is really an issue of supply and demand. You are the exploiter, the pimp, the abuser, the owner is essentially providing a good that others have a demand for. Now, when it comes to the sex trade, historically, traditionally, only the providers of the sexual services were prosecuted as criminals. And those who actually seek out these services tend not to be prosecuted. What if, in fact, you reverse things and you prosecute those who, in fact, seek to have sex with underage girls who are being held in some, exploitative situation? The studies have shown that that actually can have a great impact on sex trafficking. There was a text in our booklets, text number 9, I think is a selection on Task Force on Human Trafficking by Atsum. Are you familiar with that? Do you see that? Now, Atsum is a...
Can I have another?
You may.
Okay.
I don't think they're here, but yeah.
No, here it is.
Atsum is an Israeli organization, and you see this first line. By the way, when it says in this past decade, I believe it's from 95 to 2005. I don't think it's this last decade for reasons I'll tell you in a moment. In this past decade, approximately 25,000 women, nearly all from the former Soviet Union, were smuggled into Israel over the Egyptian border to be brutalized as sex slaves. Now, the reason is that the border between Israel and Egypt used to be an open border. It's not well known to people here living in the States, but it was much like the Mexican border, the border between America and Mexico, without any kind of a fence. And it was really very easy to act, because it's the middle of the desert. Who's going to be, running around there? The answer was smugglers tended to, and refugees. In fact, many, many people from certain African countries found themselves coming across the border because in Israel they weren't going to be beaten up or murdered or deported. And that caused a whole lot of issues in Israel. But one of the issues that this resulted in was that you had a huge supply of mainly young women from the former Soviet Union, and really basically took over South Tel Aviv. I mean, when we go in Israel trip, when we take trips to Israel with the congregation, we don't visit this area. Unless we're actually visiting the social service agencies that are actually trying to help these people, not just women who are brought for these purposes, but other people for other purposes. Interestingly enough, because of the concern about terrorist incursions over that border, fences were put up, and that's dramatically dropped the amount of basically bringing over men and women for these purposes, for that reason. By the way, if you go online and you look up Atsum, and you look up the Task Force on Human Trafficking, you'll see a nice picture of the staff of Atsum taken a few years ago, and you may recognize Rabbi Eliza Berger, who was our rabbinic intern here last year, who's in there because she did work there when she was doing her year in Israel. Very, very nice. So what is the responsibility of the consumer? What is the responsibility of the person who, for example, seeks out sexual services, goes to a certain neighborhood, and engages in what seems to be a transaction, a kind of an open transaction, what's that person's responsibility for the conditions under which that woman happens to be kept? Now let's take a look at a different industry. The tomato business. There is a place in Florida, Immokalee, I believe is the way it's pronounced. And a number of years ago, it was what you would call ground zero for the exploitation of farm workers in this country. It was a fascinating story. They were being paid next to nothing, and they were held. They were living in very, very poor conditions. Over the last 5 or 6 years, a number of organizations, including Trua, which is the rabbinic Rabbis for Human Rights organization, went in there and tried to help them. And they tried to help them in a very interesting way. At first, they sought to, you know, insist that their employers, that is to say the owners of these tomato farms, would increase the pay that they were giving to them, or would do this or would do that, change working conditions. It was very, very difficult. It often was unsuccessful. It was frustrating, and it was not really advancing the cause. And then they hit upon focusing on the supply and demand chain. And so they decided to go after, that is to say, they decided to pursue the big supermarket chains that purchase tomatoes from this particular place, and said, look, we're going to ask you to add a penny to the price per pound of tomatoes that you're paying. And they're paying very, very much less, I hate to say it, paying a lot less than what we are paying, okay, in the retail store. Pay a penny a pound more, and that money will go into a fund which will help the workers. Lo and behold, over time, they were able to actually persuade some of these very, very big food companies, and the conditions there have improved dramatically. Rabbis for Human Rights has brought rabbis there for about 5 or 6 years. I came this close to going a couple of times. I didn't in the end. But it's a very inspiring story, and you can read all about it. You
the
just
go. Film that was in the listing. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. It's a very, very interesting story, and it's really worth reading all about it. And in particular, I want to commend that site, namely, the Rabbis for Human Rights, or TRUA. It's T apostrophe R U A H. You know what TRUA means, right? You know, it's the sound of the shofar, and it's the shofar of freedom. That's the whole idea. It's the shofar of freedom. And TRUA, which is the call to freedom, is now the name of the American branch of Rabbis for Human Rights. I don't need to bore you with the politics of how the name change occurred. As you can imagine, Jewish organizations, you have all sorts of issues. But I want to say there is one document that is truly a terrific resource that I really do hope that all of you will take a look at, and that's this document. I made one copy of this document because it has 7 or 8 or 9 pages called Fighting Modern Day Slavery. Fighting Modern Day Slavery. It is an excellent document, and it includes, and I will pass it around in a moment, it includes, among other things, some important Jewish texts that I want us to look at, because I think they also help us reflect on the question of what should we do? What is our obligation? I made a photocopy of at least one particular selection that I want to share with you now, because it needs to be talked about in this context. So here, please take this. I apologize; these are not three-hole punched.
Is this Fighting Modern Day Slavery available through the TRUA website?
Yes, you go to the TRUA website, you type in Fighting Modern Day Slavery, a handbook for Jewish communities. I highly commend it to you. It is. Really, it's a wonderful staff of people. One is Rabbi Rachel Kahn Foster. I believe, was she the one who was interviewed in the second video? Is that Rachel Kahn? I think so. And there's Rabbi Gil Jacobs, who's the head of Truah, wonderful. And Rabbi Lev Meyerowitz Nelson, I know him well. He's a graduate of Hebrew College Rabbinical School. I highly commend him. So one of the texts that they bring up, and one whole area of Jewish jurisprudence that we have to know about, because it's so important in helping to shape our ethical response to trafficking and slave-like conditions today, is the area of the mitzvah of pidyon shvuyim. Now, pidyon shvuyim means literally the redemption of captives. Now, when you hear the word captives, you tend to think of people captured in war, for example. This is not the kind of captives that we're talking about here. These are kidnapped Jews that historically, especially in the Middle Ages, sometimes roving bands or sometimes other national authorities that came into the area would kidnap Jews for an important purpose. What was the purpose?
Ransom.
Ransom, to make some money. And so they would kidnap Jews, they would go to the Jewish community, and what would they ask for? Money. They'd insist on money. And it became one of the mitzvot, one of the most important of the mitzvot, or Jewish religious commandments, for a community as a whole to redeem one of its members that had been kidnapped. Now, why? What would be the reason that you'd want to go to such an effort? Why was it such a valued mitzvah for a community to redeem a captive? Why would they go to so much trouble? Why do you think? And by the way, they even discuss whether if there's a woman held in captivity or if there's a man held in captivity, which one should we redeem first? It's a very interesting question. What's this all about? What is the concern about the treatment of captives in captivity? What kind of concerns would you have?
Well, they're going to be potentially abused.
They're going to be abused, okay? They're going to be exploited. They might even be wounded. They might be killed.
Yeah.
I mean, anything can happen. It's like when you have someone in a hostage-type situation, then, you know, as they say, it could be as good as dead. That's how serious it is. So this became, and the best way to look at it is to take a look at the Jewish law in this case. Take a look at the second selection. Go pass over, pardon the allusion to another holiday, pass over the first selection. Look at the second selection from the Mishnah Torah, Gifts to the Poor, Chapter 8, Mishnah 10 to 11, or Halacha 10 to 11. Redeeming captives takes precedence over feeding and clothing the poor. So what does that mean? That means that a community, of course, is responsible for feeding and clothing the poor. And by the way, I shouldn't say of course, because in America today this may not be the case. People may not feel that way. But in Jewish communities, the Jewish community as a whole took responsibility upon itself to feed and clothe the poor. That is a sacred duty of a community. But if one of the community has been kidnapped, guess what? That takes precedence. Okay? And then Maimonides goes on. Can everybody see it here? I've got it here. And there is no commandment as great as redeeming captives. For a captive is among the hungry, thirsty, naked, and is in mortal danger. So you see how he legally makes that leap? It's very, very interesting. He's always worried, you know, you're not going to really get it. So what he says is, look, feeding the hungry? You are feeding the hungry when you're trying to redeem a captive, because he is hungry. You know, in other words, that captive has all of the liabilities of anybody else in the community, plus some. Okay? He goes on. And one who averts one's eyes from redeeming him or her violates the Jewish legal and Jewish ethical principle. You shall not harden your heart, and you shall not shut your hand. That's a that's a verse in Deuteronomy chapter 16, or 15 rather. And don't stand by your brother's blood. That's chapter 19 of Leviticus. And you shall work him. You shall not. I was wondering about that. I was going to take a joke. Shall not work him with hard labor before your eyes. And notice the verb there, the adverb, I should say, with hard labor is befarech. And anybody who's ever been to a Jewish Seder, I guess that's the most common kind. But if you've been to a Pesach Seder, you'll know that at a certain point in the Seder, we talk about what does it mean to work the Jews bifarech. That's a Hebrew word. It's the same Hebrew word. It means ruthlessly or with cruelty. So you must not work someone with cruelty. And he has neglected the commandment, you shall surely open your hand to him, the person who needs your help. And the commandment, and your brother shall live with you. And the commandment, you shall love your fellow as yourself. And the commandment, save those who are take to death. And many like these. And there is no greater, it should be, commandment than redemption of captives. So Maimonides, he can't stop. I mean, he just keeps telling you. So that is giving us a hint that if, for example, in our society, we know that there are people who are being exploited, we have an obligation. So now what we're supposed to do about it is another thing, which I'm going to hold off for a second. Well, maybe I shouldn't hold off for too long. Yes?
I was just going to say that the counter to that is there are a lot of people who don't believe you should give in to kidnappers because you just spur on their computer activity, whether it's the pirates off the Cape of...
Let's take a good example, okay? Let's say, God forbid, you know, a member of our congregation is kidnapped. And we get a notice and it says, you know, pay up $5 million. Okay, so we say to ourselves, you know, that's a lot of money, but you know, Chaim is a nice guy. He's not the nicest person, but you know, like really, he's worth $5 million.
Really?
Let's assume. All right, so you raise the $5 million and you're ready to pay over the money, and guess what they say? They say, no, you know what? We're not going to give him up for less than $8 million. And then you look around and you say, gee, people have been kidnapped in other places and nobody's getting $8 million. I mean, even $5 million is a lot of money.
For Chaim.
For Chaim, it's a lot of money. Okay, so what do we do there? Do you pay more and more and more? Or do you reach a limit at some point? And why do you reach the limit? So that is being discussed in the top top excerpt. And it's a very, very interesting excerpt because there's a term used here that will be used in a way that I'll bet will be contrary to what you would expect, given that this is a commonly used term. The term, of course, is tikkun olam. What does tikkun olam mean for most people? Tikkun olam.
Repairing
the world. And what do we associate that with? It's such a lovely mitzvah. We want to be doing tikkun olam. Give me an example of tikkun olam.
Doing good things.
Doing good deeds. Like what?
Feeding the poor.
What's another example of tikkun olam?
Animals.
Taking care of animals. Oh, sounds wonderful. Recycling. It's tikkun olam. What else is tikkun olam? Almost anything is tikkun olam except keeping kosher, observing Shabbat, these other particularly parochial Jewish practices. But certainly these you know, sort of universal social justice initiatives, we tend to lump them under this category of tikkun olam. Okay? That's not how the term is used in this section, but it's actually used in a way that I think we'll find very, very illuminating. So with that is, and by the way, that's an allusion to Hanukkah, which is coming up. It's illuminating. So who would like to read it to us in the English? We do not. Who'd like to read it? You want to try it? Ken.
We do not ransom captives for more than they are worth due to tikkun olam.
Yeah, we don't ransom them for more than they are worth. Wow.
We do not help captives escape due to tikkun olam.
Ooh, we do not help captives escape due to tikkun olam. Boy, both of these are real. Let's take a look at these. So, number one, let's look at the second one. Why don't we help captives escape due to tikkun? First of all, why wouldn't you help captive A escape from a crowd of 10 captives, let's say?
Oh.
What about the others?
What about the others? You know, it's that famous scene, isn't it, in the movie Spartacus. I'm sure that everyone here has seen that movie several times. Okay, Kirk Douglas.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Spartacus. Everyone's Spartacus. You must see that film. Fantastic film. Actually, the outtakes of that film are also worthwhile, but we're not going to spend the time on that. But there's a wonderful... Spartacus, of course, the name of a Roman slave. That is to say, a slave to the Romans. Okay? And he is in this... underground dungeon at one scene in the movie. I don't think it's giving away too much. You're going to forget it by the time you watch the film. So he's in a dungeon. It's a prison, okay? And you know, the slaves are down there, and the master, not the master, the person, in, their guard, let's say, you know, every, you know, couple of times during the day, he takes some food, dumps it down from the ceiling, from the next level, from the, and then all the prisoners go around and just grab the food, okay? So Spartacus, Kirk Douglas, of course, who, by the way, I think just turned 100. He should live a long life, okay? He turns to the other slaves and says, we gotta get out of here. We gotta escape. So, they don't know what to do, and then suddenly they, like, he's got those eyes and that brain, and he realizes that he hears something, and he realizes that there's water flowing just outside, on the other side of this stone wall. And he gets this idea that if only they could get the water to come in, the water would fill the chamber and they could float up to the top and escape out of the ceiling. Brilliant idea. So, in fact, he gets all these other very, you know, very strong and muscular slaves to help him remove a stone brick from the wall. Fantastic. They're successful. The water starts coming in and they realize that, you know, that they're going to together be able to float to the top and escape. And then all of a sudden, one of the slaves in the back says, what about me? And he's chained to the wall. You'll have to watch the film to see what happens. But, you know, obviously, what might be good for one slave might not be good for another. So, of course, if one slave escapes, if you help slave A to escape, it's possible that the master will just slaughter all the others. Who knows? And their conditions may worsen because of that. They may be worked even harder. Remember what happened to Moses. That is to say, what happened when Moses complained, right, about the slaves, and they asked for, you know,
more
bricks and half the wall. You're right, exactly. So things can get worse. That is a very interesting concern. Now jump to the top halacha that we jumped over. We don't ransom captives for more than they're worth. Why? Why don't we pay more money than they are, quote, worth? It's, after all, going to result in the freeing of this particular slave. So why don't we do it?
Because we're Jews, only by
it's exploiting the resources.
So you've got a resource that presumably could be used for the whole community, and you are focusing it on this one person, and what would be an alternative? Why wouldn't you do that? Why? What else could you do with that money? Yes.
Well, it's encouraging the kidnappers to do it more and more and more.
Right. So you could say it's you could say that it's encouraging this abuse to continue. So you've looked at this text. You've seen. By the way, the term tikkun olam is a term used in this context. How would you translate that?
For the good of the community.
I'm sorry, loud?
For the good of the community.
For the repair of the community. For the good of the world. In other words, sometimes you don't focus on this one person, you focus on the global community of slaves or of captives. So, you've read all of this. How does that inform how we might respond when we hear that, for example, there are... Well, I don't know. Let's say that some of our clothing, for example, comes from a country where the average worker is essentially enslaved. How does it impact if, for example, we're buying our food? You know, it's amazing. You can go into a local grocery store. You can get food from Chile, from Mexico, from all sorts of places all year round. And it's possible that some of the workers that are involved in harvesting your food, maybe the chocolate, that maybe that chocolate gelt that you eat for Hanukkah, which, by the way, you can get fair trade Hanukkah gelt provided by Truro. Okay? Maybe it's been produced under conditions that we might consider to be akin to slavery. What is our obligation? Yeah, Heidi.
Well, this is one of the parts that I found disturbing about the second video, is when they asked the Rabbi, she said that people often ask her, you know, what should I buy?
Right.
And she says that she wanted them to think instead of the sale and
Elohim
and think about the worker instead of the product.
Yeah.
And I do sort of understand that she wants to shift the focus to the worker and make us think about that, but I didn't find the advice as helpful because ultimately my interaction is a monetary one, with the exception of domestic workers who may interact with me and my family, mm-hmm. and that's a different case. But in the case of buying something...
Well, you're absolutely right. That first of all, I agree with you that I think she didn't really have the time to develop that point. Because that's a very puzzling point. You'd expect her to say, well, sure, don't buy this, you know, Madras shirt that you know is produced in this sweatshop factory that happens to be across the world. Instead, do this. But I think that the focus on the person is a way of getting you to see the issue from a different angle. That's the sense I get from her. And I'll explain what I mean. You are right. Heidi is right when she's thinking, well, gee, at that moment, what is my choice? My choice is either to buy this product or not to buy this product. But in fact, those are not my only two choices. My choice is to maybe join and support an organization that might, in fact, be able to change the working conditions in that society. Maybe I actually can do more to change the trading policies of this country. In other words, I think ultimately she would agree, no, you shouldn't buy this product if you know it's exploiting these workers. But sometimes, actually, there are unexpected consequences for making choices like that. Sometimes not buying that product means that the entire factory goes out of business and all those people have $0 to spend instead of $1 to spend. So it's complicated. And that's why I think by talking about the person, she's asking you to try to address the problem in a more holistic way, as opposed to simply looking at it from the point of view, should I buy this or should I not? You know, it is often the case that well-intentioned people can do a lot of harm to people. And it is also the case that, particularly when we're dealing with international trade, you can actually turn things in the wrong direction, quote unquote, well-meaningly. Yes?
Well, let's say where you can make a good choice, for example, coffee, right? Because there's a lot of fair trade coffee companies mm-hmm. that only... I think you should, you know, because that would encourage okay. the growth and mm-hmm. development of
what do
more
we think?
Companies that
do we think that?
Fair trade.
Do we think that? Do we think, for example, that we should not, you know, we should not purchase that, you know, $10 a pound coffee? Instead, we should spend the $20 a pound coffee for that fair trade. You know, by the way, all sorts of strange effects occur when you try to do, you know, we try to have these economic calculations. I can give you some examples of that, but yes, please, Risa, what do you think?
You could also spend the $10 consciously to mm-hmm. try to repair the conditions instead of just buying fair trade coffee.
Yeah, I mean, I think what she's trying to get at is the fact that if we just focus on, you know, only buy, you know, and I think there was a sentence in one of the texts that really puts it, if you really look at this stuff very seriously, you're not going to want to buy any food from anywhere. You're not going to want to buy any clothing from anybody except your mother who's going to sew it by hand, right? Okay, yes.
But the other side of the coin of raising the minimum wage,
yes.
The argument is that you're putting people out of work, there are going to be fewer jobs.
You know what? Life is complicated.
Yes.
Ethics are complicated. Right. The ethics, you might say, are simple. Applied ethics
right.
are very complicated. It's really not easy to figure this out. But one particular perspective I think the texts and these interpreters would agree is the wrong perspective to take, and that is to ignore the problem. And to be apathetic to the problem. Okay? That's the piece that I think is clear. What exactly one should do is really not always so clear. You really don't know. Yes, Dawn?
I think it's interesting, though. I've done a lot of work with people in the procurement industry for my job in public relations. Procurement and supply chain management. And what's happening is that there's a corporate movement to raise awareness. And so even if sometimes we don't think that we can do certain things,
mm-hmm.
you know, there is the power of the dollar and it's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, a few things are happening. For instance, I was at a conference last year where this woman, I think her name was Lucy Siegel from the UK, she and a couple of other people, they founded this organization and they made some film and it really shows what's going on in the fashion industry and the exploitation of kids, you know,
in that industry. And as a result of that, there are a lot of major fashion brands that are now signing on to, you know, producing their clothes ethically. And also, within corporations now, there's more and more, from what I'm understanding anyway, this movement toward sustainable supply chains. Because when you're in a big corporation now, you know, most of the stuff that you produce often is produced internally. And so, you know, it's happening. And so more and more businesses are voting with their feet. They're sort of doing it for us, for all of us. And it shows that we can make this movement crescendo if we do the same, either by, you know, boycotting or not boycotting, or doing our own thing to try to raise awareness, you know, in other areas where things are happening.
Very interesting. I'm not quite sure I totally get one point, which is, how does any one individual's action contribute to that whole impact?
So in this particular, it was really interesting because this woman that I heard, mm-hmm. she is a former journalist, or maybe even a present journalist. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, she had the power.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. I think that an individual consumer in a store, you know, trying to decide whether to buy this really fancy packaging on the fair trade this or fair trade that, you know, has one simple choice, but you wonder what is going to be the ultimate impact. Whereas I do believe that if enough people contribute to organizations that are actually trying to address the problem in a more global way, results can occur. So I'm just, to me, that's one of the great, one of the most, I think, upsetting features of these ethical challenges of the first half of the course that we've been looking at, is that these are very tough issues for us to fight individually. You know, think about it, mass incarceration. You know, you read about it, you want to take an antacid pill and then go back to sleep. What are we going to be able to do about this, right? What can we do about, you know, these problems of the effluent going into the Gulf of Mexico? You know, these huge farms with all their excrement going into the Gulf. What are we going to do about that as individuals? But when we work together with others through organizations, NGOs are the typical way that we describe them, non-governmental organizations. And by the way, probably I would say in this country as well as worldwide, they're going to become even more important henceforth. I mean, when you have an environmental protection agency that may be headed by somebody who actually wanted to do away with it, I think it's pretty important that non-governmental organizations pick up the slack. And I think that will happen. But I think that the challenge is figuring out how to do that and what exactly should be done. Was there another hand up? I didn't mean to ignore people. Okay. I just want to read you two little excerpts from this wonderful packet, and I'll pass this packet around now, on fighting modern-day slavery. What I like about this is that it has a way of summarizing and concretizing the challenges. So, for example, and I want to bring this up because of Heidi's comment. It talks about the Jewish imperative to fight modern slavery. Now, remember, one theme we keep coming back to is this is not a class in ethics. It's a class in Jewish ethics. You know, we should all have like a big J there, right? Not because Jewish ethics are better than non-Jewish ethics, but because we're looking at it from a Jewish perspective. These are the glasses. They say, you know, we all take off the glasses. These are Jewish glasses. That's the whole idea. These are Jewish lenses. So what is our, you know, through our history and our historical experience, we look at things in a certain way. They might be different from other people, but this is what, so what are the Jewish lenses, or you might say, what are the Jewish values that inform our approach to modern slavery? So they, in this collection, I think it's really true, they sum it up with 7 points. And I would have made a copy of this for everybody, but 57 pages, so I'm just going to read it to you, and then you can get an electronic copy yourselves. Number one, we were slaves. That's a powerful way to sum it up, right? We were slaves, therefore, nobody else should be slaves. Okay? Number two, we have a duty to protect the most vulnerable members of our society, whoever they might be. That's a very, very old Jewish concept, and you can see it even in these texts that we've seen, where we're supposed to redeem captives, where we're supposed to feed the poor, we're supposed to clothe the naked. These are obligations of the Jewish community. It's very, very important. Old, long time. Number three, fair treatment of workers. That's a very long-standing Jewish principle in Jewish law that you even have in Deuteronomy, that you have to pay a worker before the sun sets. You can't wait till the next day, because, in fact, he or she may be depending on that. Fair treatment of labor is a very core Jewish principle. Number four, we're all created in the image of God. That's the piece that's so essential. The reason it's so essential here is that it's very easy, since these are Jewish ethics, they arose in a parochial context, it's very easy to say, well, let's take care of our own. Let's not take care of anybody else, let's take care of our own. And that's an understandable point, especially if Jews are being victimized or abused. You want to take it, you know, charity begins at home. But, in fact, if everyone is created in the image of God, it can't be on the backs of anybody else. You have to look out for everybody else. Number four. Excuse me, that was number four. Number five. We have a very interesting rule, which we you know, forgive the expression, we passed over a few minutes ago, which was the prohibition against buying goods that were produced unethically. In other words, as the buyer, we receiving stolen goods, for example, is forbidden in American law. Receiving stolen goods in the Jewish tradition is also forbidden, but even more so, we have to avoid products whose supply chains, to quote the term that that Dawn brought up, include documented human rights abuses, and to support independent monitoring of worker conditions. Okay? That's another principle. Number six, redemption of captives. I mean, we have a duty. Now, of course, we can't pay too much. We're supposed to pay market value. What does that mean in a day like this? Okay? Because, in fact, there are cases where not just Jewish organizations, where Christian organizations go out to redeem slaves, to try to free slaves in Africa, for example, and then they get complaints from human rights organizations that say that their work is increasing the number of slaves. Very, very interesting, very troubling, very troubling. Mm-hmm. Finally, number seven is the simple, I shouldn't say so simple, mm-hmm. but the simple principle of tzedakah, of justice and of gemilut chasadim, of kindness. Justice and kindness. They imply that we should behave in this way. So those are seven principles, and I think they make a lot of sense for all of us. But again, what we actually do specifically, not so easy to figure out. Now, there's also a nice other additional piece that I mention here, because I think this comes up in the same context, which is, why does slavery still exist in the 21st century? We already alluded to this, but what would your answer be? Okay, they're still poor people, so therefore you have a...
They're vulnerable to being taken advantage of.
Okay, fair enough. Mm-hmm.
There's also a sectarian feature in Africa.
Okay, very important.
Some of the animist people are being enslaved by others, basically because they're considered not fully...
Human.
Human.
Okay, so you've got...
I was trying to find a nice way to say it.
Yeah, or subhuman. Subhuman, basically. So you've got both ethnic, religious, racial prejudice, which results in the dehumanization of certain people. You also have some serious economic dislocation, or you really have the very, very wealthy and the very, very poor. And once you have that, by the way, you have very, very wealthy societies and very, very poor societies. You have very, very wealthy blocks and very, very poor blocks. And once you have that, that's a toxic combination. It can easily lead to exploitation and to abuse. Another reason that's given here, so one answer to this problem, this question, is global poverty. In fact, global poverty is rather intense. We're shielded from it most of the time. You know, we go to a... We take a lot for granted in this country. We go to the grocery store. Guess what? There's food on the shelves. You know, in the days of the former Soviet Union, the joke used to be that every once in a while there actually were food in the food stores. You know, people would wait in line for days sometimes to get food because the economy was in such terrible shape. Another source of you might say, this phenomenon of 21st century slavery is migration. You've got the migration of peoples, and you've got the migration of desperate and destitute people. Think about all of those. How many were they? Hundreds of thousands of refugees fleeing Syria and Iraq, fleeing on boats, you know, weighing down these boats to such an extent that if the boat should sink, they'd all drown. Think about the desperate. Think how desperate you have to be to get on one of those boats. Think about it. And so, you know, it's interesting because it raises the question. So what should we be doing in a case like that? Should we be, you know, paying more money to patrol the waters to prevent those boats from leaving? Is that how you do it? Or do you do it in a different way? What do you do? What do you do? Violence and turmoil. Corporate interests, okay? Visa policies that allow for exploitation. For example, some categories of U.S. visas for foreign workers tie a worker to a single employer. And that is a way of really making sure that that employer becomes their master. It gives the employer the upper hand. If the worker complains, the employer can simply cancel the visa and have him or her deported. Like that. And finally, the low status of women in many parts of the world contributes to the existence of sex trafficking. That's clear. Yeah?
The second to last point that you talked about the visas, that happens in what I consider to be gold-collar jobs as well.
It happens gold, where?
Gold-collar jobs.
Gold-collar?
It's an expression for, for high-tech jobs.
Oh, H-1B visas.
Right, yeah, the H-1B. Mm-hmm. You're tied to the employer that, that hires you.
So even people who might be making more than a minimal amount of money might also.
I saw when I was a resident.
I beg your pardon?
When I was a resident, the foreign residents who were here on visas to be there, they were taken advantage of by the attendants and asked to do things that they wouldn't ask us to do because they knew they wouldn't say no.
Okay. So my question for you is, did anyone say anything?
No.
Oh, God, no.
Really?
No.
I mean, people alluded to it, of course she's going to ask him to do that because she knows he will say no.
Wow.
Do you think that's prevalent in most hospitals, or just do you think it was confined to perhaps your experience?
That's a long time ago because I'm old.
You're going to have to speak louder because my ears are not picking this up. Yeah, but on the other hand, you know, in many industries which employ a lot of immigrants, you tend to have this kind of possibility of abuse. In the hospitality industry, for example, you know, so many of the... And again, the law of unintended consequences is so amazing. You know that in many, many hotels... You have this notion that when you are staying over for a night, you get a clean towel in the morning. Unless now, you know, you put up these signs that say, no, I want to use my towel again because, after all, it's green. I don't want to produce more suds. And it turns out that that actually can have a negative impact on the employees. And I beg your pardon? I don't know the exact details. It was explained to me a number of years ago by somebody, and it was pretty disturbing. But in other words, that there is clearly an economic interest by the employer in doing this. And, of course, it does seem to protect the environment. After all, there's nothing wrong with that. But something about the way in which the actual maids and others who take care of the rooms are compensated meant that they were actually being even more exploited under this new system than under the old. So I don't know the details, but that's how it was explained to me, and that's a very disturbing thing. Again, it reminds you how little knowledge we have as individuals, but how much more can be learned by working together. I'm going to pass this around, as I promise, because we're wrapping up this class, coming close to the end. And what I want to share with you, though, because I think it's such an interesting and a colorful story, and it may in fact be one thing that we take with us as we move beyond this material. And that is text number 11 from Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer. You know, this is a midrashic collection. That means it's a collection of stories and tales and legends and lore that in some cases teach ethical principles. So let's take a look at this, because this kind of is a reminder that as complicated as things are, it doesn't really let us off the hook. Okay? So this brings us back to our core ethical responsibilities. I'm happy to read it. Unless would somebody else like to read it? I meant to ask. Would somebody like to read it? Robin, would you like to read it?
You're more than welcome.
Okay. So at the beginning of the third day, the earth was as flat as a valley, and the waters covered it completely. What third day? Is this like the third day of the World Series, or what third day? It's the third day of creation, right? The world is being created, and the earth is flat as a valley. But when God said, "Let the waters be gathered," when those words came forth from on high, mountains and hills arose from the sides of the earth, and the waters were scattered all over the land as valleys were formed, and the waters flowed into the valleys, and a portal was opened to the Garden of Eden, from which plants were seeded all across the land. See, this is like that wonderful, wonderful scene in Fantasia. Okay, that movie from the 1930s in which you see a visual, colorful depiction of the creation of the world, okay? Mountains and hills arose, the waters were scattered, okay? A portal was opened to the Garden of Eden from which plants were seeded, every species of tree and fruit tree, and all kinds of grasses and herbs. Rabbi Yehoshua said, okay? The depth of the earth is a distance of 60 years walk. That's how far you go down, okay? It's very, very deep, okay? And one Tahom and one fountain which sits directly over Gehinnom flows from, Gehinnom is Gehenna or hell, sits directly over there, flows from there and brings forth warm waters that provide pleasure for human beings. The image is a very, very disturbing one. You might say it's a sweet one, but it's a disturbing one. That, and by the way, the source of this image is this idea that you can go to places which have hot springs. Right? We know that, right? I don't know if you've ever been.
What's that to do with slavery?
You'll see. There are places that you can go where there are hot springs that bring forth warm water from deep beneath the earth. So what he's saying is, well, you know something? This is bringing forth water, but where's what's under the earth? The hell is under there, according to the early rabbinic imagination. Okay, when we died, where did we go? We go down to hell or Hades or any of the other depictions of the earth below. That's hell. Hell is a place of evil. It's a place of sin, etc. But it's providing warm water for us. There's a very clear image here that sometimes, you know, our own pleasure, maybe even seemingly innocent pleasure, comes out as a result of some kind of evil. And it may look very distant. You know, 60, how many, how far did 60 years walk? That's really far away. But still, that's where it comes from. Today, oh, I'm sorry.
But also that you don't. A lot of people don't know. You don't know where it's coming from. So it's what you're saying about.
It's also true.
If we do something or buy something, we don't know exactly how it's going to affect everything.
You know,
so it's analogous to that.
I do think that there's, it's almost as if what I think the message of this unit is and the message of some of these other units, and I don't think it's just intended for this purpose, is to support the organizations that collectively are seeking to educate us, to guide us in our advocacy, and seeking to address these serious, serious problems. We just can't do it alone. Because so much is not known on an individual case, but what a group can do is quite powerful. So I do think that for all of these issues that we've been studying, addressing the problems of the exploitation of animals, of the exploitation of the environment, of the exploitation of other human beings, whether through incarceration or through this kind of involuntary servitude, these are problems that are really big. And we can't necessarily solve them as individuals, But the impetus for solving them is that feeling, that uneasy feeling we get, that that pleasure came as a result of someone else's pain. That heavenly place that we're in, you know, came as a result of someone else's experience.
What's he saying? We shouldn't go to the hot springs.
Again, I'm really trying to stay away from the question of what exactly we should do and what exactly, right, you know, how exactly we should respond to that awareness. But one thing is clear, and that is that apathy is indefensible. Yes, Dawn.
It's been interesting for me, too. I've also, for my job, I'm now promoting a college whose core focus is sustainability. And I was having a discussion with the chairman of the college, and he wrote this article about how basically, you know, change starts in school, which we all know. But what he was saying was that when you go to college, you're basic, or probably in high school too, you're basically taught to buy into the system. You know, I'm just making this up, but it's like, you know, we learn about the Industrial Revolution, rah-rah, you know, America progressed or whatever. And so what he's saying is you have to change the whole way you educate. And, you know, like in every course, thinking about the sustainability implications of what's being taught, and that if you basically promote a different way of thinking, that's not exactly easy,
right,
but that's how you start to get people to act differently and collectively.
I'm going to put it differently, but I think it's harmonious with what Dawn said. Ethics is subversive. The study of ethics is subversive because it can lead you to realize that there are injustices in the world around you and that you should do something about them, and that you should not just complacently continue to eat your Cheerios. That's just an example. I didn't mean to either endorse or to say anything wrong about Cheerios. But you get the point that we have this implicit cultural bias toward being good consumers, going out there and buying more goods, selling more things, just, you know, sort of keeping the machinery going and not challenging the assumptions, the ethical assumptions of our society as a whole. And I think that's very, very important. And that's why I said what I said about the importance of non-governmental organizations. Perhaps in our country we've come to take for granted that government will play that role, will protect the environment, will protect the exploitation of low-paid workers, will protect us, you know, protect people who are being trafficked. That may or may not be happening enough. Yes?
But even in the situation where you find a particular cause and you support it, you always end up in a situation like the March of Dimes, where they were there to stamp out polio, and then polio gets stamped out, but they didn't go out of business because people had to preserve jobs.
So David is raising a very important question, which is, isn't the human capacity for exploitation inexhaustible? Right? Don't you have also charities that are just kind of making up reasons to take your money?
Yeah.
Of course. People are people. There's always a need to look at checks and balances with all sorts of situations, because, you know, we're only human. So we're going to see abuse. We're going to see attempts to exploit the system. But I think the rules and the assumptions that you set up are critical here. If you don't have a set of rules and assumptions that you can believe in, then those you need to challenge. I really do believe that. One last comment, and then we're going to have to close. Well, yes.
It's very easy to just follow the rule, do no harm. It's very hard to figure out what else to
do. Right, but that doesn't mean you have the right to do nothing. And the last principle I'll leave you with is Pirkei Avot. Rabbi Tarfon says, Lo alecha hamlacha ligmor. It's four words. It is not upon you to finish the task. Lo ata ben chorin lihibatel mimenu. But you may not, however, just ignore it, as Ethan might translate it. In other words, you're not free to desist from it, I think is the technical way it's translated. And that is our message. So we are now heading off into the cold, okay? I hope you've been warmed up a little bit by this. We are not going to meet next week. We are also not going to meet January 3rd, okay? That's the next Tuesday. But we are slated to meet on January 10th. We will not be doing the section on torture unless you consider attending this class to be an example of that. Instead, that was really just a joke, but because actually torture is a serious, serious matter, and I really don't mean to make fun. Advanced directives is the first of those issues. And the whole issue of the ethics of determining how we should receive end-of-life care. You know, what is ethical at a time like that? What's ethical and what's not ethical? And if you think this is just theoretical, you don't know what's going on. I mean, this is not theoretical at all. This is very real, and it's something that we need for our own sake and for the sake of our loved ones. Okay? By the way, any questions, any comments, any reactions, reflections, feel free to shoot me an email. I really would like your feedback for the first half of the class because we are going to be moving into different material in the second half. Did you want to raise your hand? Okay. Thank you all.